This is the September 12th, 2014 edition of WFAE Talks. I'm Greg Collard, news director at WFAE. Today, a new voice on WFAE Talks, Katie Herzog. She's stepping in for Lisa Miller. Katie is the coordinator of social media at WFAE and a web producer. She'll tell us about some of the projects she's working on and chime in on other topics we discuss. Welcome, Katie.
Thanks for having me.
Are you honored to be here?
Enjoying
the WFA Talks family?
Yeah, long-time listener, first-time caller.
All right. Great. Well, that other voice you hear is Ben Bradford. Ben, by the way, came into the office this afternoon with muddy shoes. Care to explain yourself?
No. I don't care to explain myself.
You just think it's appropriate to come into the newsroom
I do,
with muddy
track
shoes?
Them through. Yeah, no, we'll have a story hopefully next week, should be next week. That's looking at one of the biggest pollutants, actually what the in the county in North Carolina, the biggest pollutant to our water, which is actually sediment runoff, which doesn't sound that exciting, but when you consider it's the thing that bothers water quality experts the most, then yeah, you start looking at it. So I was over at a construction site and walking around there, seeing how they try to prevent that from happening, how the county inspects it and all those different kinds of things.
Good story to come. When's that going to be done? We haven't discussed deadlines on
that. We haven't discussed deadlines on that. Perhaps that's a conversation we should have off the air.
Okay. Well, before talking to Katie later on about social media, we're also going to discuss the merger activity going on with some big Charlotte companies and Duke Energy's appearance before the state Supreme Court this week over its rates.
Sure.
Ben, you covered the arguments in Raleigh this week. How was it?
I did. It was a court hearing where there were legal technical arguments before a panel of judges. So that was about as interesting as that can be. But no, I mean, the case that they're talking about, the whole thing is pretty fascinating. Essentially, the utilities of all stripes, but in particular power companies, have to go before the North Carolina Utilities Commission. And basically, they have to justify when they want to raise their rates. They're regulated. They are a monopoly. So the trade-off for them getting to be the company and to get the return on that and getting to be the company that makes the profit off of giving us energy is that they have to have the utility approve when they want to increase how much they charge us. The trade-off to that is, of course, that if they want to build more plants and everything like that, then it's going to cost more money, and so we're going to have to pay more. So the utility, you know, we've had a big conversion from coal plants to natural gas plants over the last few years, and Duke has had some pretty large rate increases, and so large, I guess, relative. But over in 2011, they raised rates. Let's see here; I don't have the exact figures off my head. I have to go back and look at it. But and then they raised them again in 2013, and the cumulative total of that was that essentially the average ratepayer pays about $14 more a month than they used to, which, you know, in an individual payment might not be a ton, but it's
significant.
Yeah, that's right. And over the course of 12 months, it can add up. Mm. And especially when you look at, you know, people who have a hard time affording those bills already, that's an extra challenge. So the Attorney General's contention and some environmental groups' contention, and they've gone to court about this, is that the Utilities Commission didn't adequately take into account the kind of changing economic conditions for customers. And more broadly than that, it essentially means that they didn't take into account what that would do financially to those ratepayers. You know, can people afford that? And the utility takes into account what that does to their rate of return. You know, are they going to make enough money to be able to, when they want to build a plant, go out, say to the market, hey, say to, you know, financial entities, hey, give us a loan. Mm-hmm. And give us a loan so we can go and we can build up this big natural gas plant. You know, they looked in, you know, very thoroughly at essentially what it is that these guys need to do to make enough money to be able to get those loans and get enough of a rate of return that investors are going to be interested in, shareholders are going to be interested. But what about like us? What about just the ratepayers that have to pay these bills? Are we actually protecting them enough? And so I think that, you know, so the case itself is looking at sort of this one particular thing. Did the Utilities Commission, which has to approve it, consider it enough? But
there's a lot of skepticism over whether they consider the ratepayers enough, because the Utilities Commission has a lot of people with ties to Duke Energy or past ties, and so how do these arguments play?
Yeah, I think that's really the broader question that we're looking at here is, you know, there's a larger context. This is, you know, you look at, for instance, the coal ash spill, which we've covered a ton of, and the overarching question when you when you look at coal ash, is not about how does Duke store this ash. And it's not about, you know, are regulators using the right methods to make sure that we're safe. I think that the overarching broader question is, are our regulators attentive enough? Are they, or are they...
Whose side are they on?
Whose side are they on? Exactly. That's exactly right. Whose side are they on? And you know, there's a U.S. Attorney's Office, the U.S. Attorney's Office has started an investigation into the ties between Duke and state regulators. And I think that this is another aspect of that. This is another aspect where, in this case, it's the state attorney general, who is almost certainly a 2016 gubernatorial candidate and a Democrat who's going to be charging Pat McCrory. So there is a political context to this as well. But the overarching question is, you know, in this case, are our state regulators, in this case, the Utilities Commission, who decides what we pay, are they on our side or are they on Duke's side? Or is it in between? And ideally, I think that you want it to be in between because you want that it's designed to be in between. It's designed to be that the Utilities Commission makes it so that this power company is viable so that we can have energy and so that we can have stability to our energy, but at the same time that we're not getting gouged.
Mm-hmm. Who's on the commission?
Well, they're appointees. Yeah. So, they're appointed mostly by the governor. Well, I think they're all appointed by the governor, although I'd have to check that. And they serve, I believe, 6-year terms. And mm-hmm. So it's a mixture.
But he's gotten to appoint three off the bat.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It might be 4 at this point. I might have to go back and look. But that's right. So and there are questions, you know, of course, about that. They have industry ties, many of them, and which, you know, again,
it's not necessarily bad.
No, not at all. I mean, it's to be expected. You want people. I think you want people making these decisions to have a basis, you know, have a ground about it. They need to have some knowledge of the situation. At the same time, in any of these kind of situations, it becomes difficult to say, all right, well, how do you make sure that you get the people with the right experience who have the right knowledge? But also, you know, aren't going to show favoritism to their former employers and so forth. How do you get that kind of the right mix? What's happened to this point, we mentioned in our stories, it's become almost a routine, is that the Utilities Commission approves a rate. You know, basically Duke and there's another body, it's called the Public Staff, mm-hmm. which is a state body that's there to basically argue on behalf of the customers. But they're constrained by all kinds of different rules. And they also are looking at the same thing. How do we give Duke, in this case, enough money that they can, get the return that they say that they need to go get loans? And, mm-hmm. and how do we make sure that they're getting enough to go get their loans to keep building? And so these two work together, and they come up with a settlement. And then the Utilities Commission kind of rubber stamps that. That's kind of what we've seen over the past. And then the Attorney General appeals it. And we've had that 5 times now over the last just couple of years, 5 times. And the Supreme Court's had mixed decisions. We've seen them send some back to at least one they've sent back to the Utilities Commission to do again, and another one they've validated. And so we'll see what happens with these ones.
Another story going on, business circles in Charlotte, Chiquita and Family Dollar are both they're both the subject of some takeover attempts.
That's right.
So what's going on here? Why are these companies being targeted? Is this, you had a story this week that this is just kind of the sign of the times is going on everywhere.
Right. It's actually a really interesting time. We've seen not necessarily the number of mergers increase, but the projected this year, the projected amount of mergers from the Institute for Mergers, Acquisitions and Alliances, which tracks these kind of things very closely. Their projection for this year is that it's going to be over $2 trillion worth of mergers. And because it's the same number of companies, but a much higher dollar amount, that tells you that it's much bigger companies merging. And I think that if you look at the individual industries, so obviously Family Dollar, you're looking at retail, and there's some pressures there as Walmart and mm-hmm. as like Target, for instance, have over the last few years moved into selling produce and things like that, for instance, right? We've seen supermarkets squeezed. I think that you can see, you know, discount stores squeezed by these big chains.
Yeah, Family Dollar recently announced it was going to start selling beer.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they're looking for for some way to get out from under that. But beyond just, you know, looking at and those are significant, but beyond looking at just the industry itself, you know, more widely we're seeing these mergers happening. And I think a lot of it has to do with, as we continue to come out of the recession, you have essentially, during the recession, businesses were cutting, right? We saw the hours of productivity, which is essentially how many hours people work. When productivity is how many hours can you squeeze out of one employee? And we saw that increase while there were also major layoffs at companies. So essentially, companies are getting, you know, tighter and tighter and tighter, and, you know, quote, more efficient, which also means that they've, you know, laid off as many people as possible and so forth. So there's not a lot of growth to get from squeezing your company down anymore. So you've got these very slim companies. At the same time, the stock market has gone up much faster than sort of the sluggish economy has, and a lot of companies are holding on to a lot of money, so they got to spend that money. It's also a great time to borrow, but not a good time to invest in bonds, or it hasn't been, at least, because of course one of the other things that happened during the recession is that the Federal Reserve cut interest rates. That's the whole quantitative easing, mm-hmm. and it poured a lot of money into the economy. And so at the same time, that window might be ending. As the economy recovers, we know the interest rates are going to go back up. So it's a really good time to borrow. That window is closing. They have a lot of money, and they don't have a lot of room to grow by just cutting. So essentially, one easy way to do that for investors who feel pressured to who are pressuring you to see some profits that are much faster than sort of the overall economy, you know, at a rate that's higher than the overall economy is growing, is to go buy something else. Mm-hmm. So, and that leads to a couple things. So I think Charlotte might very well be part of that. But the other thing that we've seen that's so interesting in Charlotte is not just these mergers, but it was, you know, Katie and I were talking about before we came in here, is this slew of hostile takeovers hostile takeover attempts, I should say. Mm-hmm. And we've had that in both cases, both in Family Dollar's case and in Chiquita's case. Mm-hmm. And in both cases, it played out the same way, which is that they announced an agreement with one company, right? In Chiquita's case, it was Fife's. They're going to do with this thing called an inversion, mm-hmm. where they acquire Fife's, they buy Fife's, but really they're moving to Ireland and moving their headquarters out there. It has some tax implications. And all of that. And then in Family Dollar's case, it was that they are going to merge with Dollar Tree is going to mm-hmm. Acquire them. Pretty quickly, in both cases, we saw another competitor come out and say, oh, no, we're going to make another bid. In Family Dollar's case, there's this history of the family control, the Levines controlling right. it. And part of the agreement with Dollar Tree had been that that they would keep that they would keep Howard Levine as the CEO. If Dollar General were to merge with them, that would be much more in question.
Right.
So
and the jobs that are here in
well, that's another question too. Is that you know, in both cases, both in Chiquita's case and in Family Dollar's case, there's been assurances at least that not much is going to change in terms of the job situations at their headquarters here in the Charlotte area. And of course, if you have these other mergers, it would be that's much more up in the air. But I think what you see happen is these companies feel this tightening window. They see this asset out there. They see a competitor getting it. Essentially, you know, what you see is this that they bid for this company, the hostile takeover. It's as much to not let their competitor get the business as because they see value for their business. And then, of course, that sparks a bidding war. Dollar General, which is the biggest chain, which is the one that is trying to do a hostile take, they've announced that they're going to force a vote at the next shareholder meeting. In the other case, in Chiquita's case, they have felt pressured enough that they said, okay, we're going to negotiate. We're going to open negotiations with Cattrali Safra, which are these two Brazilian companies that have combined have collaborated to mm-hmm. try to buy Chiquita. And they've said we're going to open our books to them. We've signed confidentiality agreements with them to look at a merger. At the same time, we still urge shareholders to vote for Fife's. So you see resistance on both sides, but in kind of different ways. Mm-hmm.
Katie, mm-hmm. These are public radio stories that you'd find. These are type of stories you would see a lot of public radio stations cover. Are important to our community, but how do they play on social media? And
well,
I know you're a big, one of your big things is to try to get audio that goes viral.
Oh, anything, man, here? Other people are fascinated by Chiquita, yeah. Fife's, and Family Dollar.
Yeah, it's like Kardashians and Dollar General.
Right.
Really,
yes. Yes.
These things don't play that well on social media. Is kind of what we found. You know, and there are probably a lot of reasons for that. For one thing, these issues are complicated, mm-hmm. and audio tends to not go viral regardless. There have been very few pieces of, you know, and viral in sort of the really big sense. You know, I'm talking millions of hits, mm-hmm. you know, things sort of, you know, get tens of thousands of hits maybe, and that's good for sort of a public radio station online. The only piece of audio that's sort of ever really gone viral was a couple years ago, this producer, an NPR producer, you might remember this, he had two young daughters, and one of them cut the other one's hair, just butchered her haircut. And then he interviewed his little girl. Do you guys remember
this?
Yeah,
I do. Yeah,
absolutely. So he interviewed his little girls about this, and it was cute, you know, a two-minute piece or whatever. And that went viral. And that's sort of the most successful public radio viral
wow.
story.
And it's still kind of classic, though, isn't
yeah,
it? Because
yeah.
it's still like the, you know, the little kid, yeah. you know, Johnny bit my finger or
oh,
whatever.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, and it's a really cute story. But it's also sort of not important, you know. And so these things that actually do have sort of import kind of tend to not really take off in these sort of social spheres. But there's been, you know, NPR has been working with different member stations about experimenting on how to sort of make audio be a little bit more shareable. You know, and part of that is things like you write headlines like it's a BuzzFeed article, you know, or an Upworthy article.
Now, the challenge for that is, okay, do you reduce your credibility a little
right.
bit? That's
right.
As a news director, it's always
exactly.
What.
Yeah, and there, you know, there's sort of ways around that, like having a sort of a clear division between news and social news. Mm-hmm. And it's the line between social media, marketing, and news content is really blurry, I think, at this point for all media people. And because this is all very, I'm the first person to have this job at WFAE.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my counterparts at other stations are the first generation of these jobs. It's not like any of us went to college for these things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of experimentation and trying to, you know, figure out what works and what doesn't and how to be fun, but also be serious is sort of the, I don't know, that's kind of the difficulty that I find.
Now, this week you went with Marshall Terry to interview the owner of a doomsday prepper
mm-hmm.
store.
And mm-hmm.
and one of the things he brought out was a flashlight that acts as a taser.
A taser, yeah, yeah. Marshall thought when he, you know, you press one button for the flashlight and one button for the taser, and it makes a really loud noise. And so Marshall thought that it was just like a noise to scare mm-hmm. people, but it's a real taser.
Now, if we got sound of him, of Marshall getting tased, would that have gone viral?
I think that actually, yeah, I think that might take off. You know, I was thinking the other day about that, the YouTube clip of Marshall eating that hot pepper from a few years ago. Yeah, I looked at that the other day. It's got, you know, over 300,000 hits. It's video. That wouldn't have worked as well as an audio piece, probably, I guess, because you wouldn't be able to, you know, see Marshall writhing around on the floor in pain.
He eats the hottest pepper of all
yeah.
time, essentially,
yeah.
right.
And then has some hallucinatory experiences,
yeah. Yeah.
falls
so.
On the ground and
yeah.
so forth. And it was, yeah.
Yeah, there's a link on our Facebook page.
Oh, God, he's gonna love that we're mentioning this again, because he
yeah.
loves nothing more than when people bring up that video.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
the guy who shot that video sent us an email this week, Tanner Latham. He's in Atlanta now, but he heard that piece and from Marshall, and then he wrote us an email saying, you know, we missed an opportunity. You could have combined the prepper with the pepper.
Yeah.
yeah.
yeah. yeah. I actually left the prepper store with a purchase. I got kind of into it while I was there.
What'd you buy?
I bought a 5-day survival backpack, and it's camo. So I think that's the first step to survival. But so presumably, you know, if there's some sort of disaster, I'll have 5 days. Got dehydrated food, some water in it, playing cards.
Nice.
I think that's essential.
Yeah, that is big.
You're a big hiker and everything.
Yeah,
you like the woods a lot.
Because, yeah.
Outdoors person.
Yeah. I could actually use it.
Yeah. But that's big, not just because, you know, then you can entertain yourself, but also you can make friends in the post-apocalyptic
it's
world.
It's true. Although I might want to be alone if this is like a walking dead scenario.
Right. But that's, explain just really quickly what the doomsday prepper thing is.
It's, you know, it's just about how to survive in the end of the world. And I think there is an element of sort of kooky militia, but it's also, you know, I think that there is something about this time right now that nihilism seems to be sort of having this resurgence. You see a lot on TV, you see a lot of sort of doomsday, post-apocalyptic TV shows that
huge
I
in pop
really
culture
love.
Right now. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of people into this that you wouldn't necessarily expect to be into.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. So it is sort of fringe, but I think it's also, when I was buying the backpack, I was thinking, you know, I could be like starting something weird right now. Like I'm going to go back next week and get a water filter and maybe a knife, which is like, maybe I'm going to cross the line a little bit, but also I think it's frankly kind of smart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean especially, you know, when you work at a radio station, you spend a lot of time listening to the news. And the news can be really depressing. And especially right now, I think there's just a lot that's happening that is kind of scaring people. And when you listen to it for 8 to 10 to 12 hours a day, you sort of absorb it.
So what I'm saying is, backpack sounds like a smart idea. I mean, you know, I remember being a kid in California, and we had to bring in things at the beginning of every year. We'd bring in canned food and some other, packages of Pop-Tarts and things like that in case of earthquakes. Yeah. Case the idea being that you'd have that you needed to have a certain number of days worth of food at school in case there was an earthquake and you got trapped or whatever. Because you're clearly going to have you're going to be at school and you're going to have access to that box where you've gotten everything in the event of an earthquake. But I don't know. I mean,
Doomsday Prepper stores should be huge in San Francisco. Oh, yeah. Well, I don't think they are, though.
I don't think so either.
There is. I mean, I was actually in San Francisco a couple years ago, and I was probably listening to the NPR station there, and they were talking about how nobody in San Francisco knows how to turn off their gas line. And I thought about that, like, I don't want to live here. It's not just the earthquakes. It's sort of like the fires after the earthquakes.
Right.
Well, what you have an idea this week, or you just as a test case to see, go back and re-interview the guy for a specific segment that to see how it plays in on social media.
Yeah, so I'm going to go back next week. I called yesterday and I spoke to the guy who owns the store, his fiance, who's also a prepper. I guess it brought them together. And she, very nice, very friendly. And I'm going to go and talk to them next week about what Marshall's interview was really about, this store. And so this piece is going to be about how to survive the apocalypse. In my head, the story will be called How to Survive the Apocalypse in 90 Seconds, because that's one of these things that we're learning about virality, if that's a word, is you got to keep it short, you know, and also put that in the title. So there's all these sort of like, it's just sort of an experiment.
To tell people that it's not that much of an investment of their time.
Right. And 90 seconds to learn how to survive the apocalypse.
Hey, you can't beat that.
Big payoff for very little investment.
Well, another thing you're working on with this a photo NPR Photoshop site, a Tumblr site.
Yeah. So this is, if you're curious about what National Public Radio and public radio hosts look like, this would be a great site for you. It's NPR Shopped. That's shopped.tumblr.com. I've been taking photographs of national hosts and photoshopping them in weird situations. So I think the one that's gotten the most attention so far is from the Nirvana album Nevermind from like 1996 or something. There's the iconic image of a baby floating or like swimming in water with a dollar hanging from a telephone or a fishing line. So I photoshopped Garrison Keillor's head on the baby, which is, you know, it's freaking people out. So
any response from him on this?
Prairie Home Companion shared it, and I don't think that Garrison probably saw it, but they're social media people.
So the point of this is to just get people more familiar at the same, have a little fun, but get people more familiar with some of the voices you hear. Is there more to it than that?
Also to promote, you know, the shows that we're having. So like today I did one that's Car Talk as the Cheech and Chong guys, which the resemblance is actually uncanny. One of them looks like Cheech, one of them looks like Chong. It's very weird. And so, you know. So here's the image, and also P.S. listen to Car Talk at 10 on WFOA. So also try to promote our work, but have a little bit of fun with it as well.
Okay. Well, Katie, thanks a lot. We'll look forward to seeing more of that. And Ben, I know you got another interview to go to.
Yep. All right.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Cool.